You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to a very special encore episode of Words and Pictures. I'm Bill Dodge.
And I'm SW Conser. Back in 2006, we made a pilgrimage to Seattle to interview the legendary Sherry Flanagan. Her popular underground comic Trots and Bonnie has recently been reprinted in a hardback collection to be released in September of 2020.
For the sake of more sensitive listeners, we'd like to mention that this interview includes frank discussions of sexuality, violence, race, and representation.
And during this time of social distancing, when KBOO is unable to hold its traditional spring membership drive, we'd like to encourage you to support community radio by going to kboo.fm. And now, Sherry Flanagan, recorded at Seattle's Jack Straw Studios. This interview first aired on September 28th, 2006.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, once again reporting from the road. I'm Bill Dodge.
And I'm SW Conser, and we're joined today by a very special guest, Sherry Flanagan. She's been a trailblazer in the history of underground comics and made a very entertaining appearance in the documentary Comic Book Confidential. Welcome, Sherry.
Hello.
And we're in Seattle today, which is your hometown. There seems to be a great many artists from Seattle whose work delves into dark themes. I'm thinking folks like Linda Barry and Jim Woodring. Something about the climate here, the long, damp winters with the fish belly skies.
It's very dark, very early. That's what people don't realize. They move up here from California and discover that there's this darkness that descends around 4 o'clock. And that's when everybody kind of holds up and draws a lot, mm-hmm. and writes a lot and thinks depressing thoughts.
You created a really influential comic for the National Lampoon called Trots and Bonnie. And tell us a little bit about the characters in Trots and Bonnie.
Well, thank you very much for getting the name right, because most people end up calling it Bonnie and Trots for some reason. And I don't know why that is, and it's kind of a silly name anyway. But Bonnie was actually the name of my dog when I was a kid. So I memorialized the dog in this comic strip. But tell you something about the characters? Well, they're very much, Bonnie is very much me. And I hate to say that because she does take off her clothes a few times. But what she does that's really important is she doesn't react to things. She's really slow in reacting. So she's kind of a different character, because most of the time your lead character in I'll call it dramatic piece, does all the action, and she's just a kind of a sounding board for the world going on around her, which I really related to when I was writing it. And because she doesn't respond, things can play out in front of her, and then the dog can have the tagline. And then she has this little friend who is actually modeled on friends that I have who carried guns in their purses and are instantly having a... They did, yeah, this woman. They respond immediately with an opinion on any given subject. And that's her little friend, Pepsi. And that was... You know, Pepsi was the drink for those who think young. You know, it was sort of Hollywood, yeah.
We thought it might be a Pippi Longstocking reference.
Actually, I stole the art style from a cartoonist named H.T. Webster, who was doing a comic strip called Casper Milktoast back in 1915, 1916, went to the Chicago Art Institute, and... his mother was a friend of my father's family. So we had this sort of personal connection that made me feel a little bit better about stealing his art style, and also about, really liking what he was doing with his work, because it was very realistic. But not realistic like Marvel Comics. It was realistic like you looked at it and it looked like a real person, not a, you know, what they call Bigfoot cartoons, you know, the big feet and the kind of distorted faces. These were like totally not distorted cartoon characters. So I adopted them. That was part of our, the Air Pirates, this group I was involved in, which I guess you know about.
Absolutely.
There was a big legal case.
We had like, you know, you'd call it like a salon, an art salon, like they have in France, in San Francisco, where we were all learning to do cartoons at the same time and kind of all learning and all teaching each other. And we'd have people who, you know, would come in and want to work with us, and we would actually weed them out.
Sort of like the Zap artists that were working on Zap.
Zap Comics, the very influential underground 60s comic.
Absolutely, yes.
Even though you don't talk about it in Comic Book Confidential, Dan O'Neill is talking about it right before you in the movie.
So give us the background on the
please.
Salon.
Well, you know, Dan O'Neill really was the ringleader on this, I think. He had this comic strip with the San Francisco Chronicle called Odd Bodkins.
Yeah, classic.
And he was fired 3 times, and I guess the last time stuck. And he decided that he was going to make some waves in the world. I mean, the war was going on, and it was an anti-military industrial complex kind of statement to go after Walt Disney. Because Walt Disney, according to Richard Schickel's book, the Disney version, held the patents on the, I don't know, warheads and things like that. And you can read it. Yeah. Well, that was sort of a Bible for these guys back then, and I was sort of a hanger-on and learning how to play with the big boys in the cartooning market is what I was doing. So Dan had this idea to hire winos and dress them up in police uniforms and have them like laying around San Francisco all day, and that would be their job, would be to lay around San Francisco in police uniforms and distribute our comic books. That was going to be our distribution system. And they'd be policemen one day, and then another day they'd be like, you know, firemen or doctors or whatever.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it was a great idea. He was full of wonderful ideas, and we all, you know, loved him because he was so much fun and such a great ringleader. And he found these guys that had had sex fantasies about Minnie Mouse for, you know, since they were 5 years old and just were sucked into this plan. And were incredibly talented artists because they'd been drawing Minnie Mouse nude for a long time.
And which seems so odd.
Which is exactly what happens in Air Pirates.
Yeah.
Minnie and Mickey are doing it in jail.
Yeah.
And you find out what they look like with no clothes on.
Yeah. And then you find out that they were actually married.
Right.
You know. And
those weren't nephews.
And they were the illegitimate children that before the marriage, I guess. And yeah, so it was. These guys had a lot of fun drawing those books, and they let me draw sometimes.
A lot of fun until the wrath of God came down.
Well,
or the wrath of Disney's lawyers.
Yeah, the people that act like God. Anyway, didn't it take about 12, 13 years to finally settle the lawsuit? It was a long time, wasn't it?
Well, there was within a couple of years, there was what they call a summary judgment, which told these guys not to publish any more comic books.
Yeah.
So everyone was scared away by that, except O'Neill, who was out on the East Coast organizing artists.
The Mouse Liberation Front.
Yes. And they were out there selling mouse balls, which are little malted milk balls. they're selling them to support their cause.
We were laughing about the fact that Phil Frank, who was drawing Travels with Farley at the time, put little Mouse Liberation Front logos or whatever you want to call them in his strips as kind of a support. He didn't actually mention what was going on with the Air Pirates exactly, but...
No, just a great little inside joke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what he was doing when he was 5.
It's too bad that there don't seem to be so many outlets for underground comics as there used to be.
Oh, hello.
Yeah,
Well, the head shops closed.
Right. And also National Lampoon went down the tubes back in the 70s. They had an entire comic section into the 80s and 90s even. And, you know, Tross and Bonnie was definitely one of the standouts. And what was, I don't think this was intentional, but I noticed a similarity between Calvin and Hobbes, which came later than Tross and Bonnie. There's this animal character who's kind of detached, a bit of a Greek chorus. And then there's this kid character who's much more, you know, taking in all this information and processing it. And I wonder if that was ever an influence or if it's just something that's floating out there in the ether all the time, kind of a mythical thing, the child and the animal.
I would say Ether.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's Skippy is another comic strip, I think, that was a little kid and a dog, and Little Orphan Annie is mm-hmm. another one that I wasn't really copying, but it's a kid and a dog.
In the old days of Blondie, too, the dogs would react to everything that was going on, usually.
Yeah.
Not verbally, but they would be in every panel and reacting in some way.
What was great to me was here was this world of kids. It was almost like an edgier version of Peanuts, almost, because here is a world that's got all of this crazy political and sexual energy, a lot of confusion, and the kids are just reacting to it in the way that kids are, but it just sometimes goes really over the top.
You are like my ideal reader. It's amazing that you're not in prison.
We're working on it.
The point is, I was trying to get to this point about how you originally started at Lampoon, because I know the magazine started, what, about 1969?
You want to know how I transitioned from San Francisco Underground to the magazine?
To Big Glossies,
to the
yes.
Big Time. Because, yeah. You know, Robert Crumb and Artie Spiegelman would, like, have these sessions with the Underground comic cartoonists in San Francisco, and they'd sit cross-legged on the floor and talk to them about, you know, in a little circle, in a little spiritual circle, and they'd talk to them about how important it was for them not to sell out to the overground, and they used to trash this guy, Von Bode, who...
Von Bode, yeah. The guy who
famous,
came up with Cheech Wizard.
Wonderful artist who influenced graffiti artists.
Oh, all over the world, if you go to Europe. And the movie Wizards was based on his work.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of youngster graffiti artists that don't even know that they're borrowing from this now legendary cartoonist that was on the same pages with you, along with Jeff Jones. And why were they trashing him? Because he was too slick, or because we
too
loved
slick,
him?
Don't be overground. Oh. You know, that's, you know, I think with artists, there's some people who really want to be a select group and feel like they're the avant-garde, and they get kind of a thrill out of being part of a small group. And that was never my orientation, because I started out in underground newspapers, and I was thrilled to work in underground newspapers because I could take the art and line the catbox with them. I just thought that was great. You know, here's a bunch of throwaway art, you know.
Fish wrap.
Yeah.
Now Crumb and Spiegelman are on the cover of The New Yorker. Oh, irony.
Well, it was irony back then, too, because Artie was working for Topps Bubblegum and made all his money doing, you know,
wacky packages.
Funny. Yeah. So he was actually working for the Overground and telling people not to work for the Overground. I've never confronted him on this, but I mention it every now and then when I get a chance.
You still got to pay your bills, though. I know that Crumb was pretty famous for turning people down a lot. But the way those of us that are running around trying to draw comics now or do animation, a job's a job. And you don't always have to put your name on it.
And he had an ex-wife to support, too.
Exactly.
And then when you got one of those, then you really have to make some bucks. So anyway, that was the environment at the time in San Francisco. The Lampoon used to send out recruiters.
Mm-hmm.
And this wonderful man, Michel Chiquette, came to San Francisco and was working on a project called the Someday Funnies. Mm-hmm. And he had all these really famous people like John Lennon doing comic strips for this book. And it was a great idea. And he came out and he got us to do some, the Air Pirates. He got the Air Pirates to do some comics for him. And we all did and sent them in and never saw them again. I don't know what happened to him. And but because he did that, Bobby and I were married we got married, and we went back to live in Queens with his parents for a while, and we just went to the Lampoon office and hung out.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So this is the legendary Bobby London, who did a strip called Dirty Duck for National Lampoon, and then later he was the guy who was tapped to do the daily Popeye strip in the late 80s for newspaper comics, and he had grown up doing E.C. Segar's style, the guy who originated Popeye, and also I think George Harriman's style, who did Crazy Cat.
Merton of the Movement, too. We loved that. And I think you guys both worked on a thing that was pretty short-lived in Seattle called the Seattle Simpleton.
Yes, we did do that. That was a tabloid newspaper style. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Yeah. They were in somebody's basement, and they all got burned. So if you can find a copy, it's a collector's item. Yeah.
Seattle was quite a scene for cartoonists back in the 70s and early 80s.
Then. We thought so. Yeah. And for no particular reason. It was just there were a lot of important people artistically here. Gary Halgren worked with Doug Fast, who started Splendid Sign Company and revolutionized sign painting for the Pacific Northwest, if not the whole country.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on the road today in Seattle with Sherry Flanagan.
One thing about some of the underground cartoons, the ones like Trots and Bonnie that ran in the Lampoon, was that you know, they shocked a lot of people and offended people, but there was always this underground, this undercurrent, this literary and political background that was very sophisticated, such as, I'm remembering one in particular where Bonnie goes down the street to a rich neighbor girl's house, and they're playing with the shrunken heads of Latin American rebels. And, you know, and this is just outrageous, but it's really wonderful stuff. And nowadays, you'll see cartoonist animators who are trying to be over the top and trying to be offensive, and there's nothing there. It's just pure shock value. It's just pure gross out humor. You know, what happened to all the people who were trying to shock the bourgeois?
Well, you're totally getting it. That's really interesting. Although the shock value thing was always there. I mean, Rory Hayes, who passed away, was a cartoonist in the underground who did a lot of, you know, stabbing, and S. Clay Wilson, there's a lot of drunken stabbing and boob cutting and stuff like that. And I think maybe a lot of my work was in response to that at some level, just to have more meaning. But I was coming out of a very, you know, political arena here in Seattle. I was a revolutionary here in Seattle and stopped traffic on the freeway not far from where we are right now. And I think that art should have some meaning to it and have some value to it. If you're going to print it on paper and kill trees to print it, I have a way that I work through my stories and structure my stories, the whole process I use to create a comic. It sounds kind of boring, but I have a paradigm that I work through. So I think, actually, that's the basic difference, I think, is I think about it. A lot of people like to work through their gut, and I like to work through my brain. And therefore, if you give me a subject like work, I end up with a story like Trapped in the Toilet Factory, which I did for Lampoon because it was how I felt about working for Lampoon, was that I was in this sort of kind of toilety environment. But
a lot of poo-poo humor from the boys.
Yeah. But, you know, I was sort of making the best of it, and that's what Trapped in the Toilet Factory is about, this manager who really believes in these toilets. And, you know, I could parse any one of my comic strips for you and tell you what the meaning is.
Well, that actually hits on a point that I was always wondering about looking at your cartoons, is that did you ever take any flack from women readers over the fact that you were in this very male-centric environment, and in fact you were drawing cartoons that had a lot of sexual content, some of it involving underage girls experimenting, and it seems like some women would take offense at that and think that you were catering to a male audience, that you were encouraging bad behavior?
I love it that you're asking me this question, because it's totally like something that you're making up in your own male brain that it might happen, because it never happened.
Really?
No, I never got any flack at all. In fact, most of the stuff that I've written, I've got a lot of support from women.
Oh, okay.
And I did get in trouble for doing, there are two strips that I can think of offhand where I got myself in trouble, because sometimes I would process a thought, an idea, a kind of a what-if idea, and I'd process it right there on paper and create a comic strip, and it would get printed or not. And in one case, it didn't get printed, but the politics of it were really not too great. And one of those was a strip that I did for Ann Beats that she hated and several women hated.
She was a TV writer, if I recall.
Yeah, and she also was one of the first or I would say the first woman editor of National Lampoon. And she was there because she was really quick, really fast, and could make those deadlines and really funny. And she was editing a book called Titters and wanted to ask me to do something for it. And I did a strip called Rape Patrol. And the idea behind Rape Patrol was really, you know, when you start messing with women's liberation, you can get in a lot of trouble. And it was on the subject of rape. And it was kind of, my idea was, how is rape any different from really bad sex? Okay, so you probably won't even want to put that on the radio. So, yeah. So, I sort of explored that, and it was a really unsuccessful story. And the other thing that I did was a comic strip that did get printed in Lampoon, and it was called, like, Trots and Bonnie and Whiteface, and it was about, I was fascinated by the fact that Idi Amin was killing his own people, and that black people in Africa were, you know, had this tribal violence. And I just didn't get how oppressed people would kill other oppressed people, whether they were in Africa or, you know, in the slums here. And I kind of worked that out in this comic story where Bonnie is the only one, the only white kid who comes to school one day, and there's this tribal war going on by this high school Idi Amin character, class president, running around in a Boy Scout uniform, like killing all the other black kids and putting their heads in the lockers. And so I did this in Lampoon, bless their hearts. They printed it, and I still have this tape that I got from a Nazi in Michigan commending me for this great comic strip, you know, killing these people. So that really taught, that was feedback. It was intense. I mean, it really had an effect on me. It was feedback that really taught me a lesson about humor. And I think being understood in your humor is one of the big challenges for somebody who writes humor.
I think you mentioned before that the style you were using kind of threw people off because it had it gave people the impression that you were innocent or naive, but you were talking about really serious subjects like you just mentioned. It wasn't drawn like, let's say, S. Clay Wilson or whatever. It was, at first glance, it
very
looks
much
like
drawn like some of the early newspaper comics of the 20th century.
Right.
You bet. Yeah. Well, and it worked.
Yeah, you bet it did.
It drew people in unawares, and then you hit them with a 2x4.
Yeah, but you know, I think a lot of people ask me, you know, why aren't you drawing Trots and Bonnie now, and why don't you make a movie, and why don't you do something on TV? And the thing is that it's all over the place now. When I started out doing that comic strip, we didn't have that kind of freedom of speech. And I keep reminding people, even at Lampoon, I was reminding people that people died to say the F word in People's Park in Berkeley. And
absolutely.
And when I was in a really formative age, that happened. That was a reality for us. So that was important then. It's not so important now. I think there's something else to say now.
Can you tell us where folks can see your work on the web?
SherryFlanagan.com, www.SherryFlanagan.com.
And it threw me off a little bit. Your first name is spelled how?
S-H-A-R-Y. And my last name is spelled F as in Frank, L-E-N-N-I-K-E-N.
We should talk about what you're doing now. Your day job is working for, well, the Oregon version of this is Death with Dignity, but in Washington it's called
Compassion and Choices. Mm-hmm. Yes. The Hemlock Society changed its name to End of Life Choices and looked at what we were doing at Compassion in Dying and wanted to unite. So they've joined forces and become Compassion and Choices. And our main thing is that we work with people who have received a very bad diagnosis, a terminal illness, and are scared. And we can help them not be so afraid of their future by explaining to them what kind of choices they have and ways to prepare for death. And a lot of people who aren't terminally ill are ready to prepare for their own deaths. If you have a near-death experience, sometimes that'll get you to do it. You know, so there are ways to make that transition easier. And the way that we do it is by presenting some kind of control over the way you die, because most people are afraid of dying in agony, totally out of control of their lives.
Exactly.
They can't control their own bodies. The doctors are trying to, you know, we literally have had a patient who was this, you know, 98-year-old woman, and they wanted to do a colonoscopy on her 3 hours before she died. That's how insane the medical establishment is. You know, they're all about procedures and healing. And people don't want to go like that. They want to go at home.
Right.
You know, they want to go in their own bed. And nobody will talk to them about it. And we'll talk about it. I'll talk to you at length about it.
What inspired you to get involved with that?
Well, I just, you know, I saw an ad for Compassion in Dying, and I thought, boy, that sounds weird, and I'm weird. I'm going to go interview there and see what happens. And I am a widow, and so I fit right in. Well, I have a lot of dead boyfriends, and I'm a widow, and I have a lot of dead friends, so I fit right in.
Do you ever spend time with them? Just,
with the dead people?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes dead friends, if they've got.
I do. I get communications from my dead best friend.
Okay.
Yes, I feel that. Yeah.
If they've left behind work to look at?
It's, you know, the thing is that you detach. I mean, the idea of death to some people is really scary. And I wrote an editorial called Dead Boyfriends back when I only had a couple of them. And since then, I have, you know, a whole bunch more and a very worried fiancé right now.
Mm-hmm. And on the note of other work that you're doing, you released some recent art. One of the collections I've got is called Seattle Laughs, and you're in that. And I've also got your collection of trading cards, which is Wet Dreams. It's a wonderful dreamlike series of erotic drawings.
Yes, available from me on www.sherryflenican.com. And Seattle Laughs, I actually put that book together.
Wow.
And called in a lot of favors to get people to do that book. It's a collector's item now. There's some amazing people in there.
What else can we look for from you in the way of artwork and cartooning?
Oh, you know, I am sometimes in a very nice little book called Graphic Classics, which you can find if you Google Graphic Classics. And I'm doing some video documentaries. I'm writing a novel. I'm writing some fairy tales.
I'm interested to hear your take on fairy tales.
Well, you know, there's nothing naughty about them at all. They're just stories that I would like to read. I decided that I'm just going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to do other people's spec work for them and have it fall through. This is what a lot of cartoonists run into, is that you'll illustrate somebody's book and then nothing ever happens with it. So I'm going to illustrate my own books. And that's why I have a day job, so that I can afford to, you know, turn down things that don't mean anything to me, and I can just work on my own stuff. Now I really feel like an artist now that I don't have much money.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures on KABU with myself, Bill Dodge, and our co-host, S.W. Concer. Our guest this morning has been legendary underground cartoonist Sherry Flenican. Not so underground right now, though.
Thank you. The underground doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly. Well, how about alternative?
It's the alternative ground.
Yeah, that's the word they use.
Yeah, I'm not in there.
Thanks very much for joining us, though.
And we'd also like to express our appreciation to Jack Straw Productions in Seattle for loaning out their studio today for the show, and the excellent engineer, Mo. Thank you, Mo.
Thank you both. This was fun.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Okay, welcome to a very special edition